Welcome, everybody, to Taking Stock. It is so nice to be back. It's December 4th, 2024, and we were away last week due to the holiday here in the Americas, Thanksgiving. Had certainly a bunch to enjoy as far as, family and good food and trying to connect with everyone in my personal life. It certainly had been a stressful couple weeks for a lot of people, I think, and hopefully the holiday helped to de-stress some of what had built up there. And today I'm really excited, to have a mainstay on Taking Stock, pretty much the our other host, John Wooten. Thanks so much for joining us today there, John.
So generous there. You had such a resounding commitment, ever since the start, always making sure that this happens and organizing it all over and over. So I don't think that I could ever take that from you guys, but completely with you on the gratitudes and just what an incredible holiday. I don't know what it is about this time of year, but cool things happen around this holiday of gratitude.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, the weather's not the only thing getting cooler. There's certainly a lot of interesting things going on, and I know that part of the reason that I'm excited to talk to you today, just to maybe we can even hop right into it with some broader overviews. But I understand, as with so many parts of our regulatory schemata, we have some potential upcoming changes, suggestions, thoughts that you're formalizing in terms of the transfer agent regulations. And this is something that you've been working on for quite some time with some public input on your personal GitHub and in some of the other spaces where you travel online and where folks can find your work. So maybe just to start with, I know maybe a lot of folks don't always think about the transfer regulations and how much of a legacy system that they are and how they shape up or maybe don't shape up against the current ecosystem that we have financially. So just with that kind of context, what are you working on right now?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about the term regulation, at least for me growing up, that could be kind of a scary thing. But regulation, and especially regulation through the Securities and Exchange Commission, I mean, this is how we govern and as a collective population dictate how our trades get routed. I mean, we've seen over the past couple of years congressional hearings over some slight changes to the kickbacks to brokers. And there, we've seen so many fighting for these protections for us on that broker side, on that traditional side that is encompassed in the CCP regime that, terminates at that single point of the DTCC, which we've talked about so often as the only clearing and settlement and custody for pretty much all the American securities, as everyone knows. And, all this energy we're putting into these regulations, it pays off when they go through, because if something goes through and if it has everything proper, if there aren't, some people call Reg Show a regulation like Swiss cheese with so many loopholes in it, it's not very useful for a lot of retail investors when certain institutions can generate shares out of thin air for the purported purpose of making a market with securities bought but not yet delivered, which mm-hmm. can stay around for quite some time, as we all know.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot to be desired from Reg Show, which, I think we've talked about it before. It was a great step forward in terms of attempting to track or maybe even optimistically curb some of this, action where there are excesses trading. But unfortunately, what we've seen over the years since its implementation is that you can appear on, on Reg Show weeks after your IPO, and it seems like nothing happens from that. There are multiple examples of companies, suggesting that, well, it's great that we have this resource, but what is actually being done on the preventative side as a result of this data? And there are definitely some stopgaps there and some shortcomings there, I think, that have become more and more apparent as the time has gone by since implementation.
I think one of the most important things to remember with just the entire industry itself. One of the parallels for me is the art industry, which presently there's no like art exchange commission. There's not much regulation in it because it is by and large an industry dominated by the uber wealthy, so to speak. You and I, for the most part, are not investing in, you know, very high end art unless it's through some kind of security, which would be under the SEC. And some of the context that I heard at some prominent writers at The Economist was that they don't really need to have a regulatory authority for the art market because it's for the wealthy, it's done by the wealthy, and at least today, you know, they can be sort of relied on to self-govern themselves because it's in their own interest. There's only so many people in the world that are trading $500 million pieces of art. It's not like something that applies to at least, yeah, I mean, that applies to hundreds of millions of people in the American population of people that buy securities, right? And that's what Wall Street used to be like in the early, you know, 1800s, 1900s. The stock transfer laws actually mattered because it was all done between the wealthy, and there was some trading between a very small number of wealthy individuals, but by and large, people, you know, you couldn't walk down a street. You couldn't walk down a main street and in all likelihood uncover somebody investing in any kind of stock. You saw people working and, you know, they saved their money. The money was backed by gold. That investing wasn't as important in it for you and I, you know, just for normal people. And that was their insider club until in the roaring 20s. All of a sudden, Sam Insull, the first time that ever came on the show, talked about him in a book that he biography. And he was really one of the first people that started hiring boiler rooms. You know, you watch all these funny Wall Street movies from the 70s onward, where he would have teams of people just call people and sell them shares in Insull Electric. He had like 100 subsidiaries, and he would sell securities in one subsidiary that weren't tangentially related to the parent company. And all these things that nowadays we would very clearly look at and say, wow, okay, why is it that mom and pop are buying, they're giving you their life savings because you cold called them and they think that they're going to get rich off this utility investment. And all of a sudden they selectively bankrupt one sector of their business and the investors in that sector lose everything. Whereas, you know, Sam Insull had some preferred shares and some parent company. And of course they, you know, they get off fine. And it was really the first case of mass ownership of securities by the public, it's large, and not just a select few intermediaries. And the reason why is because Mr. Insull was having a tough time. He'd been taking loans from banks, investment from banks, you know, these central pools of capital, and the uber wealthy at the time, there were only so many people that, you know, back then had you had to be on Wall Street basically to have any chance of finding money. He was one of the first people that really went to Main Street and said, you know what, these guys aren't giving me enough money on my terms. I'm going to sell it down the throats of Americans at large. And that's exactly what they did. And it led to the Public Utility Holding Company Act, which unfortunately it was repealed at the start of the decade. I'm sorry, the start of the century. But that was an act that lasted for a lifetime. A human lifetime is how long that lasted, that adequately regulated that holding structure that was a big problem, and was one of the largest proponents of Americans getting into the stock market in the early roaring 20s. And then, of course, there was all of the pandemonia, frenzy, and shenanigans that happened on Wall Street itself, and the very clear and abundant lies that were told by these brokers, these banks, these intermediaries to investors like us, thinking, you know, selling us the reality that we'll get rich through the stock market. All we need to do is keep buying. And of course we saw how that ended. And that's the context of when securities regulation came into place. That's when the SEC came into existence. That's when these exchanges were no longer just businesses with a sole interest of extracting the most profit they could, but they actually now had a duty to the public that they are now serving, because it, you know, the stock exchanges, they weren't just for the top 1% anymore. They were for everybody. They were growing for everyone at that point. I'm going to reconnect my mic.
Oh, sounds good to me.
Oh, better. Thanks, Bob.
Specifically, the mic was sounding okay, and not so much the recollection of history, because it's fascinating to hear, you know, and to revisit how these different key steps, you know, each small in the moment, perhaps, but ended up bringing in this massive amount of new monetary interest from the working class, which ended up being, you know, perhaps directly connected to the massive boon that the this kind of investment in, you know, the maybe the let's call it a narrative around how to build a future began to incorporate more and more of this kind of you know, asset holding, or maybe, you know, asset investing, I suppose, since of course a lot of it is beneficial and entitlement based in the modern day. And that's something which was only, you know, the solution of the central custodial system was solving a problem which only came about because regular folks were getting so much more involved in this kind of space, which, you know, I'm all for distributing an availability to grow wealth. No problem with that. But there are certainly shortcomings that became apparent. You know, I think you're about to bring up, like, the paperwork crisis and the centralization of and monopolization of the space, and of course the dishonesty from major players in that space as well when it comes to dealing with their the clients, you know, either the American people or international investors as well.
Yeah, so now we're going to jump forward circa 50 years, and we get to that time period where it's actually really starting to grow. So before, you know, everyone kind of lost a lot, and it was a tough time. There were, you know, some large global conflicts and such, so investing wasn't really chief of mind for people like you and I. And so it still stayed relatively concentrated in the hands of a select few. But as soon as we go off the gold standard, you know, you kind of need to invest if you don't want all of your money to lose its value by the nature of inflation. And that was sort of the first, I think that was almost one of the first things that I introduced in 9 to Noon, was that, you know, the government is printing away your money at a rate of, at a target rate of 2% a year, although the last few years have been anything but that. And the only way to preserve your wealth is through investing, be it in one sort or another. I think paper assets, you know, securities are a very efficient way of doing it. And so as more and more people realize this and they understand, whether it's through themselves directly investing or through their pensions investing, you know, one way or another, the market has exponentially more participants. It's no longer just that upper echelon of society, and it creates these events where they have to kind of figure out how to make things efficient, because trading stock certificates is not efficient. Mailing certificates that you know, they need insurance, it's just silly. Okay, there's a reason why, like, yeah. So they start. It's interesting. Wall Street was actually really one of the foremost consumers of early computers, and they really pushed the envelope on Silicon Valley. They were, I think, they gave seed money or like pre-purchase money to Intel in its very, very early days. And certainly they were one of the largest consumers of the early mainframes, because it was in their interest, when they have so much more volume coming in, if they can remove 5,000 secretarial jobs with a computer, there's very clear profit motive to do that. And so that's what they did. They started automating, and as you've referenced, they centralized the certificates, got it all into one place of custody. And by and large, there was still, you know, I think there's always been some shenanigans going on down there. But it didn't seem like at least for me, it didn't seem like they were really lying to the public. They were just trying to make things better. If you look at some of, they publish like these cartoons and these early marketing things about dematerialization, where, you know, they frame it like it's any like anything you read, like any marketing you read from the 70s or the 80s, it's all nostalgic, just trying to make things more efficient, get on the road of electronic markets is a tagline I remember from a very old article. And they're just trying to digitize everything, which is by and large, you know, paper versus digital. I think there's a clear winner there for efficiency. And what's interesting is that a little bit after that, people start to realize, and specifically the guy that started the Instanet, which was the first ATS, built up computer, you know, Dalio had a similar story, had a computer in a two-bedroom apartment in New York, and that was very common for a lot of these early innovators in the space that were trying to improve our markets. And when I say improve, I basically mean make more efficient in terms of lower fees. And Instanet was the first example of somebody saying, you know what, I'm just going to start my own little mini stock exchange. And we had a whole episode on ATSs and some of the high-level differences. And what I found really interesting is that the commission comes in a similar time frame and tells the New York Stock Exchange that they can no longer have fixed commissions on trades. Ever since the founding of the New York Stock Exchange, far, far before there was an SEC, it's called the Buttonwood Agreement. It was just a piece of paper between the brokers. It was like a price-fixing monopoly agreement where they say, we're going to charge this percent commission or more on every single trade. And you can't, you know, it's like any industry where they agree collectively that these 14 or so brokers on Wall Street will not charge the 1% a lower price than this commission rate. And, you know, they said, you can't do that anymore. You've got to actually compete on trades. And I think the origination of some alternative systems was the precipice of that. And since then, there have been, you know, hundreds of these venues pop up, and they all offer the exact same service, right? You're just creating an order book where people can go and they can place their buy offers, they can place their sell offers. And by and large, the only difference between any of them has been the prices that they charge.
Yeah, that has changed now.
What's that?
That has started to change, right? I mean, this whole paradigm, and maybe I'm getting ahead of you, but talking about the brokerage fee structures, we're now in an era where the zero fee commission broker has taken over. It entered the market and forced everyone to its level.
Yeah, I remember I was giving, a local stock investing seminar right around the time when Robinhood came out and was generally known to the public. And I was doing a comparison of brokers, and I was very skeptical of the business model. And you can kind of see in there, it's like, you got to be real careful here because there's something happening. Because by and large, it used to cost hundreds, thousands of dollars to execute stock trades, if not more. I mean, imagine you're doing a $10 million stock trade and the broker has a fixed commission of 0.25%. I mean, you're just basically stealing people's savings and retirements, but you're only stealing from the wealthy. So at a certain point, they didn't seem to mind it. But after the digitization, after these new competition that by and large, the competition, all it did was force the prices closer and closer to zero, as we've implicated. But in the late 1990s, there was a quote from Trimbath, who I think is quite relevant and well-known across the community, where, you know, as the director of transfer agent services at that point, the DTCC was, I think they consumed about 80% of the clearing and settlement market. She says she finds these discrepancies where naked short selling happens. It happens, I think, by and large at start, it was the brokers sort of testing things out. I think from 1992 to 1996, they were seeing what happens if they fail on settlement. And, you know, the market, it wasn't that crazy. It was a fast growth period up to 19, you know, up to that point. But I don't think it really started going off the rails till 97, till we had that irrational exuberance quote. And I think they spent about 4 or 5 years sort of testing the playing field and figuring out how they could cheat the settlement system now that it had all become a standard system. And I think what they found was that, you know, DTCC was a member-owned organization. It was owned by the brokers. It was owned by the banks. Originally, it was supposed to be controlled by the banks, majority control by the banks. But in the autobiography of its original CEO, Mr. Denzel writes that the control sort of shifted. And I've wrote about this in the Discord in relation to updating some of the Wikipedia pages for CD. But basically, it shifts so that the brokers have a lot more influence than was originally designed. And that influence puts them in control of what they uncover is a way to make more money. And I don't know a single nonprofit broker. So if these companies figure out that they can use this settlement system that they implicitly and explicitly control to make more money by failing, you know, doing the naked shorting, well, I'd like to think that in a materialistic maximizing thesis, the board of directors sort of have an inherent obligation to steal as much as they can through that system.
It's kind of what we would expect under capitalism. And what's tricky here is that we can't exactly, you know, there are a couple of cases where you could point at, there was something strange going on here, like with Dole, right, or, you know, CMKM. There's a few examples, certainly. And there's maybe an open secret, I think, in the financial discourse that it's quite normal today for some amount of shares that are trading in the market to be in excess of what was initially issued by the company. And these couple of items together, combined with that central custodial system and combined with, I think especially today, with zero free brokerages kind of encouraging and enabling people to keep a lot more of their equity, you know, involved in this system because the wheels of access are so greased, where you can do what you'd like to with that equity. Essentially, it has really increased the amount of access that this centralized body has. And, you know, like you just said, though, we can expect that in this type of system where certain motivations exist for this for-profit industry, and we see that there's possibility to do X or Y, like, naked shorting is certainly a prolific and constant option that these guys have when it comes to fulfilling obligations. But if only the transparency were there, right, to prove that it were happening, because we can say it could be happening, and there's reasonable capitalistic explanation and motivation for it to be happening, but is it happening? That's tougher.
It's definitely tougher. I think we got some tremendous examples, and it's thanks to some tooth and nail legal fighting in the early 2000s by the Overstock team, and that we have at least some tangible data. The reliability is questionable, but it's so hard to imagine a solution to this when all of the exchanges are for profit, all of the brokers are for profit, and all of the custodians are for profit. And there's basically this Rube Goldberg machine of the entire stock trading process that exists, I think, pretty much exclusively to ensure that they continue. You know, they've made profit for hundreds of years in some cases. You look at the Fortune 5, the Forbes list, and you'll see the names of the grandsons of some of these brokers, you know, the people that founded them, still up there because there really is absolutely, there's nothing competing with them, and there's just so much convolution that sticks them at the core. I'm going to grab some water and I'll come right back, Chives.
That sounds good, John. Yeah, I'd have some myself here. Definitely need it when chatting, for long periods of time, especially about a subject matter which can really boil the blood a bit, because it is so frustrating that we live in this system that is built all around us. And for those that are curious, that are paying attention, there's a lot to be suspicious about here. And ultimately, the question becomes, if we're so sure that there are these diagnosable problems, and if we, have a reasonable expectation that there's certain, let's call it, what's the opposite of altruistic? Selfish, I suppose. Selfish action by some of these major legacy power players. Then how do we move forward from there? And I think once John gets back, I think that's going to end up being a really terrific tangent and segue back into the initial subject here about transfer agent regulation and what John is working at with block transfer and to some of the comment letters that he's drafting to send over to the SEC, especially in context of this transitioning leadership that we're going to be witnessing over the next couple of months as the new administration comes in. Chairman Gensler has announced that his final day will be January the 20th in 2025, and a new person will be coming in. And we don't know quite yet who that will be or what kind of sentimentalities they will have, but it's going to be crucial that a conversation is started from early on, that some of these items really need to be reevaluated, and perhaps some alternative perspectives about how to solve the problems of of liquidity, of universal access, of equity growth. How can we solve those problems while also solving some of the other emergent problems that the old solution has wrought, that we've just been discussing over these last few minutes? So, John, did I hear you getting back there?
Yeah, I love the principles there. I think it's so silly that there are billions of people on this planet that can't invest in some of our best equities, and similarly, we can't invest across theirs. That gets down, I think, to one of the core flaws of the present financial system. Not 2 hours ago, my partner was telling me about her idea that just came to her of building an app that could send money to all those, all the different payment apps that you have, all the different ways that you can shoot money from one phone to another. And in the back of my head, I think, oh my God, this is like absolutely impossible to do. If you're even just a simple currency conversion, good luck doing that under 48 hours. And unfortunately, the securities clearing and settlement system is quite similar. I just had an account closed at a broker the other week. I just sold everything I had there, and I'm in the process of getting rid of that account. They charged me an inactivity fee, which is just the stupidest thing to charge a long-term investor. And they sold my shares to do that. And then I asked them how much it would be to send the shares to another broker. It was $100 to do just a simple stock transfer. And that exists when you have payment systems that you and I have no influence over, no control over. It is all these proprietary, centralized, I own the list of all the shareholders, and you need to pay me $85 every single time you want to transfer stock, or you need to route your trade if you want to make a trade through a dozen middlemen who are all for-profit companies. It's just so silly.
Yeah, that's a horror story, and I'm sorry to hear about it. Far too often brokers have that kind of I guess it's a funny thing, right, John, because we talk about all this history, and there was a time where it made, I suppose, some economic sense in the broader landscape for the fee structures to be what they were. But here we are today in this modern technological environment, and we look at something like blockchain, something like a more distributed and more reliable, quick, transparent method of settlement, and it becomes very difficult to understand why these legacy animals are holding on so tight to a clearly inefficient system in comparison to modern alternatives. I mean, I say it's unclear, but I suppose on the other hand, they get to keep charging these fees that way. So that's one motivator.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think I know that these guys understand what's going on. I think we've talked about this before. You know, there was a DTCC conference a decade ago on every facet of blockchain as it applies to clearing and custody of securities, and they have done, you know, squat with it respectfully. And I've talked to C-suite guys. I understand very clearly their perspective on this technology, and it, from my point of view, looks like just a front. You know, it's just anything you would expect with a monopoly trying to forego competition, right? They'll put out all these things that look great in a press release and then do absolutely nothing with them. Because at the end of the day, they are one single central point of record keeping. That central entity, that central point of control, is exactly what Nakamoto promised and showed us how to remove. He showed us how you and I could participate in a global network that keeps a universal ledger of everyone's balances, a ledger that is not subject to secret manipulations, a ledger that is not available only to those with the ability to pay, and indeed a ledger that is not part of a Rube Goldberg machine to even access it in the first place.
Yeah, and I think it's so crucial to remember that, you know, referring to the initial, like, you know, BTC white paper that really helped to, you know, obviously popularize and jumpstart this whole idea, you know, with blockchain is, you know, this open source concept, right, which I think is so important to separate from any specific application, any specific coin or token. It is a central technology that, you know, there are now many different blockchains operating in many different ways. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked about, you know, the DTCC and Treasury, more recent digital asset reporting, where the Treasury was kind enough to lay out, you know, that there are multiple different types of chains, depending on their read permission, their write permission, you know, who facilitates settlement, who curates what effectuates an actual settlement, right? There are key distinctions here where, you know, the technology, in one example, and I think for more detail, you know, folks can check out that episode, but just in brief, right? It can be utilized in some ways by legacy players to proliferate their own ability to profit without actually implementing meaningful developments and advances for regular retail investors. That's one type of implementation, but there are other types that are closer to what was laid out in the original white paper, implementations that involve, you know, a public read access for the blockchain so that everyone can have a transparent understanding of ongoing transactions. And of course, the distributed consensus network allowing for a public write access to facilitate those new transactions. Both of those are so important if you want to divest the profit motive in controlling that information from the legacy system. We need some kind of implementation which would maintain that public transparency, maintain that public participation, and scale it up and up far beyond what, you know, we've seen so far in any of the successful cryptocurrencies. That is what would be necessary, I think, in order to really and truly realize the successful application of this technology in a, you know, egalitarian way so that regular people can meaningfully benefit. And all of that siphoned value from this, you know, as you mentioned, you know, Rube Goldberg of intermediaries, all of that siphoned value could be returned to the investors, to the companies, to the people that are actually either building something or taking risks to support those who are building something, because the financial manipulators are doing neither of those things and still walking away with a lot of profit.
A lot of profits, a nice way to say it. I love the sentiments there. I'm completely with you on the central manipulation. And yeah, if you look at wooten.link/alpha, there's an early white paper that was kind of eventually morphed into the yellow paper. And yeah, you know, I completely agree. It's really just an application of this technology, and it's this open source concept. You know, how can we figure out the most efficient and best way to do the task? You know, whether the task at hand is, you know, paying someone from across the world, trading a security, or, you know, making some art thing. And in that way, in the alpha early version, all that, I tried an implementation, or I built an implementation that was sort of doing it on sort of a more popular technology at the time. And in most of the context in the white paper, and indeed also in the original sort of documentation that I did with the USPTO, it was all sort of generalized just to this open concept of what can happen, you know, on any blockchain network, really. So completely with you on that part, Chives. And over the years, you know, I've also had a pretty good understanding, and a lot of research I've done originally was on the specifically the order book part. You know, how do you get the order book so that it's not under the control of a select few intermediaries? And there's just a lot of very technical work that goes into all that to make sure it happens. And, you know, in the original, in that alpha paper, I've kind of had the SDEX in the back of my mind since, quite some time ago. Like probably 2018 is when I realized, 2019 is when I kind of affirmed to myself that was going to be, at that point in time, it was the only sufficiently decentralized exchange. And at this point in time, it still is the only sufficiently decentralized exchange. And we had a little episode on that. We talked all about that. But, you know, it's all certainly available. If you can find some better option here that works better, you know, sure. My originally, you know, in that alpha is like, okay, well, maybe we can do this on our own blockchain. And I wrote out sort of how that would work out. And especially I wrote out how I think the fees should be applied to it. You know, it should be minimal fees. It should really just be done to prevent spam. And I found, you know, wait, you know, this applies, this is really the exact, pricing scheme that's implemented over here. And then I also found just an incredible community that cares so much about, really providing access to the world's financial system, which is, you know, growing up, I remember I would drive 40 minutes to the nearest bank that offered a free business account, just because I thought it was just stupid. I can't think of a better word right now that, you know, puts all the emotion that I have behind this in one word, but, just so blasphemous that you have to pay money to use money. Like, that is the dumbest concept I've ever, like, we have this money in society, and you're telling me that I need to pay you to use it? I've always had so much frustration.
No, it's a legacy holdover, right? I mean,
oh my God.
You know, you think back to when you had your pile of gold coins, or maybe, I guess maybe copper if you were, you know, a lower level laborer. Then if you're keeping them in this vault where some guy is hiring dudes to guard it day in and day out, There's some fees attached so that you're not keeping it in your straw bed. I suppose they wouldn't have had mattresses then, but you know what I'm saying. And, I like to say that, you know, blockchain represented the first meaningful new financial invention in thousands of years.
Yeah.
Cause otherwise it's just about doing stuff faster or at a larger scale, but we were still doing the same thing we were always doing.
Yeah, and we always had that challenge that is so clearly present with the central security system, where there's only two entries in the account. There are the debits and the credits. And if Mr. CFO decides that he wants to meander the numbers around, or if there is an institutionalized policy that the debits and credits don't have to add up to the number of shares outstanding, then you get really bad problems that nobody can fix. But when you enter this third entry, this third oversight factor of the cryptographic proof implicit in the distributed ledger technology, now you actually can have accuracy. You don't have to just, you know, rely on auditors and pray that things work and just hope Arthur Anderson figures out the problem. You can have things by design function in all the manners that you just described. You know, it's transparent, it's accessible, and it's actually accurate, because you have that decentralized network of computers confirming that, yes, this does add up to this, and this is all acceptable according to our agreed upon network, you know, blockchain rules. It's just unbelievable. What a great, you know, the Jed with Mikhailov is a well-known in the exchange space, sort of wrote all of Mt. Gox and offered the entire service for free before handing it off to the person that ultimately kind of destroyed everything, had all the security flaws, lost all the, I mean, that was all after. And I remember I heard there was a conference discussing some movements about a decade ago. And the way that they put it was that Bitcoin did something really cool that was very challenging. Like, it is something that people have been working on in the crypto space as cryptography as a research category for decades. And, you know, Nakamoto really finally, was able to do something that no one could really do before. It was a big light bulb moment that has spurred so much innovation, across the industry, because we all can now see that you can have this third entry, and it doesn't have to be a single entry book or double entry book, but we really can't have an efficient shared ledger that works.
Yeah, and I think right there, that's exactly where I wanted to go next, because I think it's very easy conceptually for people to think about the advantages of a blockchain compared to the centralized ledger of, say, you know, a bank or a local credit union, you know, that are tracking within their community. You know, it's even easier if you scale that backwards to like an older community like what I've just done. But it doesn't need to be a currency. It can be any kind of trackable asset, right? And that, as you just mentioned, you know, when you think about an issuer ledger, that, you know, they've, for 100 years, they've had to have, you know, a transfer agent as mandated, you know, by the SEC, by the Securities Act, you know, following those roaring 20s, kind of like we talked about at the beginning. And that is very similar, you know, in the modern infrastructure that is so prevalent. You know, that's the same kind of thing where it's a central body that is tracking this information, tracking the debits, tracking the credits. And it operates as a authoritative ownership resource, but it still has that central body. And it still inherently has that kind of trust because it is this, it's a legacy system applied in a different way. And similarly, and I think this is the, you know, getting back into the letters that you've been working on, you know, about how we can move this industry forward, you know, if we are to think about, you know, blockchain affecting, you know, traditional banking, traditional finance in that one way, I think there's a perfect parallel to draw, like you had just mentioned, towards the affecting the issuer ledger and the transfer agent established hierarchy in the same way with a different type of asset. Does that, you know, sum it up and tee up properly there, John?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. The reason banks are so regulated nowadays is because if you in the old days, you couldn't really create a gold coin out of thin air. Maybe you could print an extra derivative, an extra entitlement to that gold coin out of thin air. But you can't copy a physical item. But nowadays, you know, if a bank accidentally has some tech glitch that changes some number in a database, your account balance changes, and if it increases, then they've just printed money out of thin air. So obviously that needs to be very tightly controlled. And that's exactly the case with transfer agents, with the current rules. They have an Excel spreadsheet by and large. It's just this spreadsheet of everyone's balances. And if they change a number, it changes how many shares you have. I remember talking to a very well-known venture investor in Atlanta who does a lot of early deals with startups, and the private companies, it's not like specifically under SEC. There's like this blurry line between what's private, what's public. I don't want to really get into that. It would just be a long conversation. But what happened is the person that was keeping track of the shares for years had given this investment group millions of shares less than they actually owned because they read a contract incorrectly and typed a number into a database incorrectly that was worth a sizable amount of money at that point. And you know, transfer agents, there are these rules and there are these margins. Like if you have over a certain threshold of more shares than exist, you need to tell the commission. And that's because the systems aren't accurate and they are subject to all of the flaws that you would expect when you have a person sitting down typing into a spreadsheet how many shares you have or how many of any asset, like you've said that you have, which is so common across so many things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, right? It's not just about efficiency. It's not just about trust. It's about accuracy because humans are fallible. And if we had a system like a public referenceable blockchain that individuals could independently and publicly audit at will, then I suppose not only would you catch a problem like this, but more, even more importantly, you wouldn't have a problem like this in the first place, because any individual change to that distribution of asset is going to be already a mandated and agreed upon adjustment from the distributed system of nodes and on that decentralized exchange or on that ledger. So it's a multifaceted solution here, but getting from A to B, and I think it's even more than a one-letter jump, is pretty tough. So how do you foresee that kind of transitional, change in notation and change in technological utilization happening?
Excuse me. I'll just say, and I've said before, I think there's a real systemic problem with these naked shorts. And as we've seen with so many cases, there are at least a number of securities, if not a majority of securities, somewhere in that range, there are stocks that have shares that are never going to be delivered. It's just not going to happen. And if that company was bought out tomorrow, there would be problems. Like the Dole case, it's the chief, the legal system today in the Delaware courts in that case, which is the jurisdiction for the vast majority of these companies, says that entitlement holders on the broker side are not, they don't have claim against the company. Is the only one left after there's something like that happens. And it's only the investors that hold in DRS that actually get paid, because they're the only legal title holders. And there's a growing movement of understanding based largely on something called The Great Taking, which is a documentary that came out at the end of last year by David Rogers Webb, who is someone who, by and large, has their whole life in this industry and quite the experience and understanding of exactly the challenges that are going on here. And unfortunately, if the system starts to corrupt in any meaningful way, there was an amendment passed in by Wall Street in 1994 to every state securities law, which says that the short version is that if your broker goes bankrupt, they can use your portfolio to pay back their debts. Go ahead.
No, just horrifying.
It's ridiculous. It's unbelievable. SIPC is not going to protect people. We have had extensive discussion on this. There's so much behind it. It's nothing. Okay, it's pithy. There's a problem brewing here that is on the level of the financial crisis, and it's going to happen to securities.
Yeah, I mean, I am in complete agreement. There's a crisis of ownership, which is boiling under the surface, and the precedent is there, through items like Dole. And unfortunately, right, a very small percentage of individuals hold their securities in their own name, Because they do value, you know, access to a greater amount of liquidity or access to margin investing, or they want to expose themselves to the volatility of the market, all sorts of different reasons. But unfortunately, it's kind of this false pretense of folks thinking that they're making a fully educated decision when they do these different things, because, you know, understandably, I suppose, in the capitalist framework and in the legacy infrastructure, market participants are unlikely to, you know, they're not really going to share this information with anybody. You'd have to go out of your way, maybe know a bit already about why you need to look into custody, what happened in the, you know, in the Delaware court precedent, or, you know, or what is happening in communities like the GameStop community, that are getting more and more interested in ownership, before you could really identify for yourself that it's something important to look into. And The Great Taking is certainly a fascinating read or listen. He put out a book as well that's certainly worth checking out. But my my largest consternation with it, and by and large, it's well thought out and excellent perspective on some of the shortcomings of the legacy system. But Mr. Webb also does some exaggeration in there too, saying that, you know, CD & Co., the DTC's central nominee, holds, 100% of shares, which is not accurate, because there are individuals that hold through DRS, that hold in their own name, that are insulated from this problem. It's just that maybe it's a 1% or less of total outstanding, but it is a non-zero. And at least to my recollection, I don't believe that he brings up DRS even once, or personal ownership even once, in his released final versions of the documentary and the book. So I think it's unfortunate that it has achieved a great notoriety since its release, which is excellent for a general perception of the problem. But it is not mentioned this key aspect of a solution, or at least a protection.
Yeah, Mr. Webb is an older fellow, and I mean that in all the best ways of having the experience and really understanding the specific problems that exist in the American state laws that allow this loophole. But, you know, one thing I said in a very, very early kind of startup pitch for block transfer in the Venture Prize was that there are really very few people, by my understanding, and, you know, I've been doing this for 4 years at this point, and I really, you know, there's just not a lot of people that understand the finance side of the entire security system as our community so fervorously understands, and the blockchain side as to how we could actually have solutions here. And so because of that, I think there is the general public hesitancy to get behind DRS, because with the transfer agents of yesterday, you can't trade stock. It is almost impossible to do a stock transfer, and surely we've had those discussions about the physical stamps that you need to move shares, and just, you know, it's all the same problems. It's just it's a horribly inefficient system that is used by legacy transfer agents, which I believe very wholeheartedly contributes to the minute number of shares in the DRS for the vast majority. I mean, basically everybody except for a handful of companies.
I agree with you 100% on that. I think those are, you know, those contribute to major reservations people have, which is sensible. I mean, there are real and serious, you know, pros and cons to each of these methods of holding, depending on what your goals are, short, medium, long term as an investor, and what your goals are for your equity, et cetera. And, that's absolutely sympathetic to that and appreciative of that. And I think that's why it's so important to imagine a better alternative, which would somehow be able to marry the best of both of these two worlds, where you could have custody without sacrificing your access to the liquid markets.
Yeah, I mean, I got into I remember Googling what are stocks. Oh, gosh, that must have been in 2016, and it's completely changed my life. And, you know, like, markets are awesome. I think markets are just the coolest thing on the planet. And by all means, you know, stocks exist because of markets. There is no capital formation without markets. Investors aren't going to put money in a company if, you know, there's nobody on ever that's going to be able to transact it. And you and I are not going to be able to invest our money without markets. It all comes down to markets. We need to have some way to exchange and to trade. It is such a core tenet of everything that happens here. And indeed, it's the core purpose that these buttonwood brokers had those hundreds of years ago. It was finding a buyer, finding a seller, and, you know, in a simplified manner, they were just creating an order book for these stocks. And that doesn't exist. It doesn't exist today outside of the legacy system, except for this opportunity that we now have with blockchain. And very interestingly, around the time period where the paperwork was flying and everyone was trying to figure out how to digitize the industry, there was a very comprehensive study done by, you know, we had Bibic talked about these basic bankers. It was a big group of bankers that, you know, everyone came together and they said, how can we sort of do this? And there was this official report that was submitted to Congress, and there's this SEC publication that showcases everything. And there were also a lot of other documents around that time that were put in front of the House committee, the Subcommittee on Finance and Urban Affairs. At the time, though, it was put in front of a committee by a different name, because the committees back in the 70s and the 80s for securities and finance had kind of different jurisdictions. That's a rabbit hole that doesn't really make too big a difference. But none of these other studies actually mentioned this concept called a transfer agent depository, a concept that was, by my understanding of present public documentation, singularly identified in an early 78 report from the commission. And it was put out to comment, just like any other new regulation coming from the SEC. Everybody in the public can comment. There's no redaction of what you say. There's, you know, you send them a PDF or you type it in on a web form and it shows up. And they, by law, by the Administrative Procedures Act, they actually have to read everything that you write. And they have to, you know, the law says take into due consideration. So there, when you put your comments to the commission, if they, you know, they have to read it by law. and indeed, that is why they have, so many people working there, because they receive, you know, hundreds, thousands, you know, so many comments, right? And they put out so many rules. You look at the rulemaking activity, it's pretty incredible. Just the size of the volume that goes through there. And in this document, they sort of lay out the two options here. We have the system that prevailed, which was the DTCC, where you have sort of central custody and, you know, everyone works on the broker side. And you have this alternative called a transfer agent depository, or TAD, where all the transfer agents work together. And that was the concept at the time. They all work together to build a computer system that basically allows you to electronically transfer stock certificates, which at the time, that was like completely brand new. That had never happened before. That was like groundbreaking concept, to have the electronic transfer stock. And that's what they were building here. They were building the first depository that would allow the electronic transfer stock. And what they found at the time was that everybody really liked the TAD system, but it was, I mean, this was very early days of computers, and you had to invest many millions of dollars to even have a foot in the game here, to start having an electronic record of shareholders and such. And, you know, the transfer agents, historically, they weren't like the exchanges. The exchanges were always the one making the fees on the trades, and then the brokers were the ones who got the commissions on the trades. All of the money has always been on the trading side of things. The transfer agents, by and large, were just this ancillary accounting thing that you had to have by law, because you can't generally, it's challenging to trust a company to maintain its own books and records. You could just go in there one day, basically, and you could add a million shares to the CEO's account. And if you're doing that kind of on your own behalf, you know, you can, there are examples like CMKM was probably the most recent example. You know, if you, and that was through a corrupt transfer agent. You know, you can do bad things if, you know, if it's just your company and you have free nilly access to amend that Excel spreadsheet anytime that you want to change the number of shares people have. You look at some of the early Facebook lawsuits from the early employee terminations. I mean, it is a real responsibility. It's like letting people maintain their own bank account. You know, what are people going to do if they can just change their balance at will? It's not like a super complicated thing to extrapolate. And there's also a lot of other compliance things, like, you know, when you're doing it on your own, how there's a lot of work that has to go on here. And that's what they noticed in this report. You know, you've got to track not only all the trades, but like where the prices are and some of the tax basis things and actually have the compliance that makes sure people don't, you know, that makes sure that every time there are more shares created, it's done through an approved SEC process and a registered offering and all the things that this regulation was put into place to prevent. Because in the old days, Insul could just print a million shares by the flick of a finger and signing of a certificate and sell that to mom and pop. And they didn't know how many outstanding shares there were. There was no way to even understand any of that information. And so these regulations at the time of this report, right, when they were discussing whether they want to have central depository or a TAD, they had 50, 60 years. Well, the state laws go back that much, and I've investigated them thoroughly. But they, you know, they had from 1934 to 1980, they had 50, you know, nearly five decades, nearly when this report came out, nearly five decades of laws that they had made protecting investors. Well, making sure that companies can raise money and the markets are fair and free to the best extent that they can with a central entity controlling the order book. And the way that it works today is really the brokers nowadays enforce these securities laws. They make sure that everything goes through the right steps with the SEC. And indeed, by and large, when they act as underwriters, they are really buying the shares directly from the company and then selling them to the public. So they're really putting their money where their mouth is when they say that everything is up to par, it is compliant. I mean, there is a lot of work. You can just imagine filing an S-1. That's the form that you file to go public and to sell shares to anybody. You know, that's usually a 100-page, multi-100-page document for any sizable company. Because there is just a lot that these regulations impose on companies. And we could sit here and have a discussion of whether it should be more or less. I think there are actually absolutely stellar exemptions available for startups. But that's like a whole other conversation that don't require, you know, as much work to go into it, depending on the stage. And they apply really broadly to a whole lot of the cryptos that are looking a little bit more like securities day in, day on. But again, a whole nother conversation. And so, you know, this is a lot of work, like just holistically, the regulations, the exchange, the trading, the movements. There's a lot of moving pieces that need to work here. And thankfully, you can do all of these very easily with blockchain. But at the time, you know, that was 40 years, it was four decades ago. They didn't have any of this. They didn't have the internet. They had... you know, it was just so early on, and you're dealing with machines the size of rooms to track in addition or a subtraction. You know, the technology just wasn't there for a decentralized solution to emerge between the transfer agents working together. Even though it was really well supported, it would require just an immense investment. And the only people with the money to make that investment was Wall Street, because they had been profiting from this system for hundreds of years. I mean, yeah, so long. And they had that money to invest in computers. They had that money to give Silicon Valley to get them really startup capital to build the modern technology stack that we know today. So, you know, at least they got that through. That was money that was, it really had to, at that point in time, be done chiefly through the NYSE. You know, they spun out the securities depository that eventually, you know, a year after they spun it out, the certificate service from them became DTC. And then DTC just, you know, it had all the money. It had the backing of the New York Stock Exchange, which was the main profit center for, you know, because it was sort of the monopoly on trading before it was all deregulated and there was that competition with the other people with the ATSs that we talked about earlier. And so if you give all the money to this one institution that's for profit and you tell them to build the system, they're really, at the time, they were kind of the only ones that were, I remember watching an early cartoon about what the stock market is. It was like one of those cartoons that you watch about World War. It was one of those very old cartoons. You can tell just by looking at it that it is something it was made very early on in the frame of, you know, modern animation technology, because the whole thing was animated. And it was explaining the stock market and how you can take your money and give it to a broker. And the video very explicitly says that your trade goes to the New York Stock Exchange, because the New York Stock Exchange was the only stock, there was the only business in town. There was no other option, right? The New York Stock Exchange was effectively synonymous with the American stock market. And that's just not the case anymore. I mean, there are so many trading venues and so many dark pools that the large majority of volume from you and I go to, that basically steal, you know, shave off like that, you know, like a thief shaving a little bit off of a gold coin every time they make a transfer, right? And it's so different today than it was back then. But back then, the New York Stock Exchange was the American stock market, and they had all of the money, respect, and power that comes with that position. And they used it to build the DTC, which became the DTCC, which now controls the entire, is, you know, as we've said. And so, you know, it was like if we got 500 people playing baseball competing with, you know, we're playing like Little League, and we're supposed to go out and compete with the New York Mets. You know, it's just, you're going to get slaughtered. And that's what the SEC realized. And that's why Congress tried in 1975 to make sure that clearing and settlement was competitive. But the way that they implemented it was they said everybody has to have the same features because it's a common system of clearing and settlement that needs to be in place. And so while there were originally some geographic differentiation because they were still transitioning from the stock certificates, so originally you had, you know, people on the East Coast and people on the West Coast that were doing this transfer agency. You had people on different coasts doing the securities trading and settlement. You know, you would have like a securities settlement system for the Philadelphia Exchange, for Chicago. You know, once computers were efficient, the TAD system was completely forgotten. And the central custody system was consolidated into what we know today as a universal system, because nowadays electronic transmissions are so cheap. And, you know, these guys used Excel spreadsheets 3 years ago, last time I talked to their engineers. Yeah, it's just not good. Because yeah, you chime in on that if you think, Chase.
Sure. Well, I think it's fascinating when we look back at the history, right? Because the, you know, as you'd mentioned, there was this interest in this TAD system from the beginning, and that's something that you know, in Trimbath, there's an article on YDRS a bit about that, and on Trimbath thoughts about that as well, and a lot of ways from my recollection of her statements, it's a very similar admission that the capability, you know, was not there, even though the interest might have been. You had this separate sector that did not have the same access to capital and was not going to be able to scale in the same way. And at the end of the day, they needed to solve this problem. There was, you know, of course, you know, coming out of this huge influx of people investing into the space, a huge amount of complication. You know, back then, right, we had settlement time was what? I think it was like 12 days. You know, it was not uncommon for, you know, people to be running stock certificates across the street or sending them by post and Theft was common, a lot of problems. And the DTC concept, you know, spinning off a central depository, sticking a bunch of certificates in a warehouse and maintaining a ledger, this new electronic ability to maintain a ledger and debit and credit accordingly, in this system of centralized trust, again, to draw back the bank analogy. So that ends up winning out. And I think it's interesting, John, that, so there they were, 50 years after the Securities Act, roughly. And here we are, 50 years after the advent of the central depository in the American markets. And technology in both cases caught up and was enabling a new solution. And while, a transfer agent depository, encouraging, a more direct access and accountability for the issuer and for investors, people's hearts were in the right place, but the technology wasn't quite there. And I believe, right, so your, in terms of verbiage, you've talked a lot about TAD 3. And am I correct in my understanding of it? Well, that is essentially it's like a portmanteau of TAD and Web 3, encouraging the use of this distributed modern technology to achieve the regulatory goal of that faction at that time, because we've now come so much farther and this can be scaled, this can be achieved cheaply, and this can be achieved easily using this technology that has been invented in the interim.
Yeah, I have to do it aside. I absolutely love this, the runner. I heard this story from a prominent market podcaster of one of the guests on the, same kind of thing with the warehouse receipts. Warehouse receipts in futures trades are sort of like stock certificates as they were back in the day. Specifically, warehouse receipts are bearer certificates, which is kind of like how some cryptos work, where if you have the piece of paper or the keys or whatever it is, then there's no questions asked. You are the owner of that. You can transfer it to whoever you want. Nobody can stop you. It's just holding, it's like a bar of gold. It's your bar of gold if you're holding the bar of gold, so to speak. Whether that you attained it legally or illegally, it could be another question. By and large, bearer certificates are legal in every jurisdiction on the planet, except for the one that a large swath of the crypto brokers are registered in as legal entities. And we could get into why that is, but again, that would really be a massive discussion. And they're legal because it's just not an effective way to, there's fraud, there's lies, there's theft. And what I saw here, or what I heard more accurately, is that this individual, his dad worked on the futures exchange, and over the summer, everybody wants to go on vacation, so they have him recruit this person who was about 12 at the time, and a bunch of other friends from school, and have them come work over the summer as accountants, because you're just doing simple adding and subtracting. This is such a long time ago, it's kind of crazy what computers have automated. And he worked his way up over 3 years of doing this internship over the summer, and to the point where he was running. They had runners, right? You referenced these, they have people all the time on Wall Street. You would go from one broker to another broker with the stock certificate, and you would go to the clearing firm with the stock certificate. A lot of transfer agents were on Wall Street. So if you look at like the present requirements for how fast a transfer agent needs to be, they are based on a time period where a person would physically go from the stock exchange to the settlement place, which was on, it was a block away on Water Street. And then they would physically go from there to the transfer agent to get the jumbo certificates. And so that's what our current regulation is based on for transfer agent. It's based on the speed of somebody walking three blocks from Wall Street. And of course that is, not what exists. But interestingly, with this individual, they were given as part of their promotion, so to speak, as a 15, 16 year old child, the right to run these warehouse receipts, which it's just like the stock certificates at the time. They're just, you know, at the end of a futures trade, they get a warehouse receipt. And the warehouse receipt is as good as gold. You know, you could walk into a bank with that warehouse receipt and walk out with 100 pounds of gold. That's how the system worked back then, at least. Thankfully, there are people doing really good work trying to put this on blockchain. It's a whole nother, it's just a whole nother rabbit hole that is way outside my echelon. Okay, just give me stocks, I'm happy. But you can kind of interoperate that system too. There, again, there's just a whole lot that I could go into there. It wouldn't be the most relevant to this aspect of it, but definitely a cool future chat, and I appreciate you putting that in the Discord. And he told this story. He was walking down the street with a satchel of $1 million or something unbelievable of silver certificates, silver warehouse receipts. And at any point in time, you could just, you know, as he's walking to the settlement place, he could just go into a bank, get, you know, bagfuls of silver bars, get in a car and drive to a foreign country. And there's absolutely nothing they could do to stop it. So just a fun story, because that is certainly how certificates were for quite some time before mobilization. And that's sort of the environment that a lot of these regulations came into place. They're hard to protect investors, make sure that doesn't happen to mom and pop's retirement portfolio. And that was the context of where I started to learn about the American securities laws. And, you know, some state cases, I'd say probably 80% federal is my general understanding. And then, of course, the Supreme Court, all the Supreme Court cases. What I realize is that the TAD thing is all of a sudden possible because of Sassaman, right? Because of this blockchain stuff and all of the incredible developments that have happened across the Web3 industry over, you know, that was what, 2008, 2009, the Times, you know, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. And here we are nearly two decades later. There's been some unbelievable, the pace of technological innovation and improvement, you know, computers, right? Moore's Law. It's like unbelievable how innovative open source developers in particular have been around these incredible blockchain technologies and the passion that they have of sharing it with people and really making it publicly accessible. You know, the way I started learning about blockchain in high school was just reading white papers that people wrote and when they started their projects. And I think I've said this on here, but I remember asking my high school math teacher to explain some faceted nuance of the Mimblewimble protocol. And they're like, you know, this is just completely out of the league. And so I think it's a testament to just how much innovation has come without any central coordination effort, thanks to that original white paper, which again was written by someone that wasn't, you know, nobody. Respectfully, I know there's some conspiracy things, but respectfully, nobody told, you know, no one was directing the writing of the Bitcoin white paper. And it's just research. I mean, this is what research and innovation is. It just comes out of if people that are curious and that want to build something new and to make something better and they see a problem and they want to fix it in the world. And the problem for Bitcoin was the banking system. And so, you know, this big idea facilitates solutions, and that those same solutions have emerged over the years for generalized assets. You know, obviously on that particular chain, there's just absolutely no way of having scalable records for anything. Scalable records, period, and then scalable records for arbitrary stocks or any other kind of asset is another step after that. So really most of the work, behind TAD. So earlier in the episode, I referenced the alpha. That's what I call TAD 2. I think the original report from the commission being, there was a lot of work that went into that report. It's a very long and thorough and effective report. And there was a lot of other publications that are in like congressional archives that from that time period, like it was quite a bit of work to come up with the TAD concept. So I think they deserve TAD 1 as a heuristic, so to speak. And then I wrote that alpha basically it's just trying to really understand all of the laws that you have to have in place. You really need, you know, we tried free markets. Okay. We tried not regulating the stock exchange. And, you know, it's really interesting to think, like, could that work in a decentralized system? And that is what I fight for every single day and go on towards trying to figure out if we can have more crowdsourced decentralized regulatory system. But in today's system, there is an SEC there, and there are the equivalent of the SEC in all the other foreign jurisdictions, because the regulations are there to forego the central corruption that is so common in these for-profit central intermediaries. And presently, that means that you need to control the activities of a corporation. And the only way to do that is the forceful hand of government coming in and saying, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do. And so, you know, over the past 100 years, nearly 100 years, they have written very extensively. The SEC has this, you know, we kind of have the most advanced, developed, and liquid security market in the world. So respectfully, I think we sort of have the basis for how regulation, you know, there are other countries that literally copy our regulations for the securities industry. So I think we sort of have, you know, you sort of have a testament, like you can fork Bitcoin and make some new thing from it. But there's always going to be that kind of parent structure that acts as the base of whatever it is you're trying to implement. In this case, we'll call it securities regulations. So thankfully, you know, I've kind of always had a general protection from these regulations as an investor. You know, I started trading. I was too young to open an account, so I was doing it through my mom's name when I was, it's getting late, but 15 or 16, getting a little more water.
Yeah, got to stay hydrated. And I know you've mentioned that anecdote before, and it always makes me chuckle just to think of, you know, operating through that proxy. I'm sure that you know, she handled paying all any gains that you had accrued, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it was my, you know, it was like a few grand in tax. It was like, but yeah, that's how it went down. Because adults can't be trusted. I'm sorry, children. There's a whole lot we could dive into there. That's a whole other topic.
I think so.
Because the age of majority isn't the same across all the countries. Like, it gets really nuanced. And there are like actual textbooks written on the laws for how children hold securities. It's like, there's a lot to it. But anyway, all this regulation is designed to regulate a central intermediary, and it's all public. You know, that's the incredible thing. You can go and you can read the U.S. Constitution, you can read the IRS tax code, and indeed you can read every rule from the Securities and Exchange Commission. All you need to do is go to Google and just start getting at it. And I've summarized some of them and done some work to make it a little bit more accessible in some of the GitHub discussions around this comment letter. And so I just kind of read everything over a couple of years. I remember one time I was traveling to Massachusetts for a Web3 conference hackathon kind of thing. And when I got on the plane, you know, I was dressed up for the conference and such, and I was carrying a stack of papers about 5 inches thick, because at Georgia Tech you can print like 1,000 I don't think it's 1,000. It was a long time ago, but you basically could print mass documents for free up to a certain limit. And so I used that service to print the entire Securities Exchange Act as amended at the time, the Securities Act, the Exchange Act, and I think one other year I printed the Trust Indenture Act. So probably killed a couple of trees in that process. I apologize, but it was kind of the only way I could. You know, I was reading all these laws while going in between classes, and there was a lot going on, and you have to kind of pay attention and write your notes on. They want you to write notes on. I wrote my notes on my laptop, so I couldn't have it all up at the same time. But, you know, I'd be sitting there in statistics ignoring the professor, because I took AP statistics in high school and got like the 5 on the whatever. But I had to take the class because XYZ Central Education Institution says that you need to take this class, even if you yada yada. There's a whole lot we could go into on the curriculum side there.
there's problems all over the place, right? And there's another example of centralization, and greed causing problems. But I think at the core of this, it sounds like from the start, you had a healthy fascination and curiosity to understand the context under which these laws were developed and the context under which these norms were developed so that you could, commiserately move forward from that point to think about, how they might be disrupted, or maybe a kinder way to say it would be improved. And I think that's a really terrific, contribution that you wanted to make, have made, and are continuing to make that was worth, the half tree that might have been represented by you printing out those laws.
Yeah, and the beginning of that process is what led to TAD 2, which is that alpha implementation with a little bit more rudimentary controls that was designed alongside more of these centralized regulations to do the record keeping. It was designed to scale. I'm just going to go high level on the technology here, but it was designed to scale with a system called optimistic rollups that effectively mimics the key central role that the DTCC plays today through a coordinating effort between nodes and such. At least it did at the time. It was still a research project at the time. It kind of just came out as this new thing. Now I think it's been captured by some for-profit. At least last time I took a dive into it, a lot of these blockchain technologies, unfortunately, have been captured by Wall Street or by Sand Hill, and it's unfortunate. But there are exceptional projects that have not, and so that's sort of what TAD 3 is built on. TAD 3 is that iteration from the alpha, and interestingly, I pretty much finished TAD 3. The way that it works is these are systems and standards. And ways of operating a transfer agent on the blockchain, so to speak, at a high level. And, I grew up, I really gotta go to the bathroom. So, and I know we're getting to a longer side. So I'll gloss over a bit of the technical work that went into it.
Well, I'm gonna take a break there. I can chat for a bit.
Let's do it.
Because that sounds better. And I think that's then at that point, we'll be getting into the juice of it, everybody. TAD 3 and, what John has really been working on there and on the, him getting ready to submit, some more of this information, which, I would definitely encourage folks check out. He's actually just recently posted the, a most recent revision of his letter over on the, YDRS, SEC comments repo. And there'll be a link to it in the show notes. I can see if I can figure out how to put a link to it here on Twitter now. But in the interim, I'm always fascinated to hear about this development. It's the thing that I think that John does, which is most fascinating to me, is this potential bridge between the legacy system benefits to retail investors on the brokerage central custody side and on the other side of the custody on the issuer ledger. Both have pros, both have cons, but this potential implementation of blockchain technology specifically, I think is this potential alternative, which would provide the pros of both with the cons of neither, or pretty darn close to that. I mean, obviously it's up to interpretation, up to an individual's opinion, but for the things that I think need to be important for retail investors, that is the realization which is made possible through this kind of development. So I guess we'll have to see how long John is. In the meantime, certainly if there's I can offer up, if anyone is interested to have a comment or join the conversation, certainly you can pop in, just raise a hand. Otherwise, I'll see about posting the link in the Twitter thread so that folks can appraise themselves of that. And of course, always looking for more participation over on the GitHub as well. That's, going to be a great place to, whether or not you have feature requests, comments, want to actually contribute to the code base or to the developing UI and resources, over at YDRS, that's the place to do it, in a way that's going to be, immediately visible and accessible by the folks that are doing, a lot of those actual changes. If you want to participate in that conversation directly, Discord is great too, of course, but sometimes conversations flow and items get, they move past each other on Discord. So, the GitHub is a bit more organized of a way to, directly participate on an ongoing basis. Okay. Just went ahead and tweeted out a link to that SEC comments repo along with, under this space link. You should see that on the at YDRS X account. For those who are curious, check it out now. I'll share a link to it in the Taking Stock channel in our Discord as well. All right, and let's see. Sounds like John might be getting back. Sounds like someone walking around a house. We'll have to see. But I noticed that there we didn't have anyone interested to come on up at the moment, which is fine. I know it's a complicated subject matter, and I'm happy just to have John continue onward once he's ready.
Great. Oh, that feels so much better.
Good.
So over the years, I just started a repo on the Block Transfer GitHub. Right now, the repo is PyTad3 Horizon. So the way Stellar works is kind of like the core validator. And then there's always been this kind of question in the industry of, how do you have like a scalable blockchain? And there are quite a number of nuanced answers to that quandary that Stellar implements exceptionally well, in my personal opinion, that the other blockchains they don't have. They're actually entire. One thing that comes to mind is I know that the blockchain, so to speak, of a very popular peer-to-peer chatting app is based on the consensus method of Stellar, that Stellar pioneered out of some San Francisco research that has been very thoroughly peer reviewed and such and such. I mean, you can dive into the semantics, but the cool thing, the core concept was that you could sort of use the trust mechanisms in place for internet routing for validation. And that's high level. If you go on my X, like the pinned post right now it has a link to a comparison of consensus mechanisms, which are arguably the most important part of a blockchain, even though they're kind of the hardest to understand. So I don't want to try to explain them all here because I've got a 50-minute video on YouTube doing that. It's a lot. And the only reason that's relevant is because Horizon is kind of the API interface, because Stellar is fairly unique in the sense that you can have a validator, you can have an archiving node, things that you would expect on most blockchains, but you can also run this thing called Horizon, which is a public facing API that it makes it super, super easy to actually implement the blockchain into production applications because you have the validators doing, all the core network blockchain things you would expect, verifying transactions, creating new ledgers, and obviously they all share the same ledger, so updating those balances and such. But Horizon is kind of the system in place for getting that data off of a public URL, because you know, such a large part of. I remember the first time I downloaded a full. I started running a full. I tried to set up a full validator. I actually never even got it spun up. But it was just downloading the Ethereum blockchain. It was like 70 gigabytes, and it took like at least a few days to download. And so obviously, if you're trying to build something quick, you're going to need some kind of decentralized way to access information about the chain. And Stellar is one of the very few networks that does that through a system called Horizon that, again, it just interfaces directly into the core network of validators, and it's based on all the trust assumptions built into the consensus mechanism, which I really appreciate and think balances quite prudently a lot of the nuances that we have in trust. And that lets you just call, you can abstract away a very large amount of the, like the blockchain itself. You know, if you look at most blockchain applications today, they are quite technical. And there are actually entire companies whose sole purpose is running different nodes on blockchain, on different blockchains, and then giving you an API for the data from them. So now you're trusting them as a central source of data for information about a blockchain account, so to speak, and what its balance is. Which again, which obviously it just introduces a new intermediary, a new point of failure, and a new point of corruption. All the bad things that exist with centralization. But Horizon is really cool because now you have this decentralized interface, this decentralized API. APIs are so important. I remember the first comment that I did after, you know, it was the first time I ever, we ever chatted, was on the SEC API for new EDGAR system, EDGAR Next, which is the reporting system used by companies and their insiders to disclose material information. And it's just an application programming interface. It was actually like one of the first things I learned about in the only class in college that I am thankful, well, not the only class, the only coding class, that, you know, not crypto math stuff, the only coding class that I'm thankful of. Well, I guess they're all good. Back into the education rabbit hole. I'm gonna pull out of that one. The main class that taught me most of what I know in college is a class that I could have taken online for free, but I just didn't have the will. I've tried since I was on cross country to learn how to code. It was never a natural thing for me. I remember going through these free code courses day in and day out, and slamming my head against the table, unable to figure that stuff out. I know some people it comes really easily to them. My cousin's like that, like pro hacker. He's in college now. But I remember in middle school, he hacked into the computers for the entire campus, and you know, changed grades, shut stuff down. He was just having a good time. Nothing. It wasn't like explicitly malicious. He very explicitly showed people how he hacked into, you know, told the administration how all of their systems were insecure.
Sounds like a John Hughes movie.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that is the security environment in which every single central intermediary exists, because anybody that gets into their systems can change account balances and create all of the problems that exist. You know, they exist naturally because markets. And indeed, there are many instances that were documented in that EDGAR comment letter of foreign nationals hacking into American very big names that keep track of this similar, you know, stock market data and using it to profit in the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars by understanding information that's not available to the public because they hacked into these computer systems. Again, central point of failure, private, proprietary, gatekept ledgers. It creates so many problems, and those problems, they don't need to exist anymore because every single hacker on the planet is trying to break into Bitcoin, and absolutely none of them can do it. And the reward, if you can do it, is billions, trillions, so much money. And nobody, it's the biggest bug bounty on earth. And this is what I got into with the episode with Pasta that we had on kind of talking about open source development. I remember in college, the former CISO for 20 years at the New York Stock Exchange and then the parent company ICE, which is a company, if you look at their stock, it goes up and to the right forever because these exchanges are money printing machines, just like the payment systems that are public. Told me that first of all, you know, they know they're doing a good job when the pay goes down because these central intermediaries only extract rents. And so the more efficient they are, the less they get paid. And so obviously that's never going to happen if they're public.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I guess I'm just really glad that, you know, that you've got this kind of, this attitude towards it that, you know, because not everyone is built to have that same level of appraisal of a problem and think, you know, something greater than, this is awful, but it's the way that things are and we must grit teeth and participate, because there is no alternative. There clearly can be an alternative, right? Nothing exists until it is brought into the fold. And that's what, you know, clearly there's a vacuum of potential here. I think it's clear from some of the items that you've described just today, but also items that we've discussed many times, here and in other places online and, naturally are covered by dozens and hundreds of other retail investor advocates, that there is a mounting problem, a budding problem that, you know, will reach some kind of impasse in the future. And I think, one pretty wild thing just, to think about, you know, the extent of this issue is that all we can do is point at it quite plainly and say, like, there's smoke here, but because the regulatory expectation of these, you know, for-profit, self-regulating organizations that have monopolistic control, you know, is that they do not need to release any kind of detailed metrics. They don't need to succumb to independent audits that are then, you know, commiserately publicly released. They, you know, if there were some kind of security vulnerability, like you were just elucidating, there is no guarantee that we would even know about it, because there is not that level of disclosure and public, you know, public participation in the system, you know, from a top-down level, that would allow for us to understand or be aware. It's possible, right, that we already are existing in a completely fraudulent system. Just possible.
It's unfortunate. I remember Jerry was on his own podcast recently, talking with other CISOs of major financial institutions or of similar stature, you know, industry professionals. And of course, he ran the industry take group for yada yada years. Talking about open source versus closed source. And I have the exact quote in TAR, but it was something along the lines of, there's obviously one person here that's a winner, and it's not the one that hides their bugs in the vein of secrecy so common in present central institutions. I really like what you said about this idea that we really have the opportunity here to build anew and to build it how it should be, given the massive advances in technology. The Steve Jobs quotes that I will very likely butcher comes to mind, which is that if you look around at everything around you, and interestingly, this is actually what the commencement speaker for my graduation at Tech said, and it was somebody who had built a $1 billion startup out of the exact same startup program that we went through. We started the thing in college, dropped out to do it, and he mentioned this quote: "If you look around, every single thing that was built or exists, it was created by people that, quite frankly, they're no smarter than you, in the context of all these engineers and such, but really, honestly and truly, there is not like a God that says we have to have a central securities depository. We need to follow the CCP regimes. Like that doesn't exist. We're in a free market and everything is built. You know, humans are incredible. We can build highways and do things that other, you know, animals, so to speak, could never dream of because we can collectively organize and find a problem like this and go and solve it. as a group, right? It's more than just yourself out in the wild. And that's how everything exists today. It's because it's all right there in front of us. Anything is possible. And indeed, it is our opportunity to go and build and improve. And that just seems like such a natural human tendency, to see things as they are and to, you know, create the newest version. Because seriously, if you look at the committees of these people, they're really, these are systems and methods designed by people that are no smarter than you or I. And so why not let it be the system of the people?
Well, there you go. I mean, it's recognizing the space and looking to build to fill it. One thing that's human is to ask questions and identify problems, and then the other thing that's human is to build solutions to those problems. Could not agree with that anymore. And I think something that really ends up being fascinating to me about the transitional process, and this might be a bit adjacent to what we discussed so far, but just to mention, you know, ultimately, right, this is going to have to, unless you get the regulators on board, which was very, you know, I think is a great thing to be trying to do. Certainly, TAD initially traced back to, you know, SEC and to Congress recognizing the need for accountable settlement. And it's very possible that the, administration of today could recognize that same value. But, you know, adjacent to that, there is, battling them on the their own battlefield of capitalism. I mean, this system can operate at scale, using something, using a sufficiently liquid blockchain that has good enough settlement. I mean, I know that you've brought up the SDEX, through Stellar already on this call, and that being the premier example of potential there. But it's something that is offering these kinds of services. I mean, you're talking about something that can offer cheaper and more consistent reporting, more transparency, faster, and easier, release into the market of newly issued securities, so on and so forth, right? So there's a lot of different material improvements that go even beyond maybe the more moral improvements of custody and stability. There are actual material capital improvements to the system itself that are also provided here that I think is really crucial to be aware of, to keep in mind, for anyone that is listening to all this and is thinking, well, that sounds great, but it's never going to happen. There's additional context that it can, there are multi-directional pressure that it will be levied against the incumbents from this kind of technology and from this kind of attempted implementation. So I wanted to mention all that. And John, I'm curious if you have any further thoughts on that kind of, developing approach that's represented by your work.
I will love that, Chives. And thanks for sharing the discussion link that was just published on the Discord. I think really we have quite a unique opportunity given that when I saw RFK campaigning, I was so inspired that, somebody has a real chance of winning the office that isn't on CNN, isn't on Fox News. It is a grassroots free speech kind of thing. Politics are politics, and at least in today's environment, minority candidates like that, they don't have the party support, and there we could talk all day politics, about him as a candidate, yada yada. But one thing that I think is a really solid foothold. I'm someone who voted for the party that he aligned with because I like a lot of his policies, pretty smart guy. And one promise that they made was when they invested over $20,000 in GameStop during the campaign of money from a environmental lawsuit, class action style thing against corruption and fraud in a, I can pull up the exact source because it's in that article as the third image from I don't think it's very respectful to, I don't know. He sued Monsanto, okay? And those were some of the fees that he earned. And, you know, it's just routing out this corruption through the legal system. It is completely possible. It's being done every single day. Alpine is probably the pristine example of this centralization of power coming into public accountability. And we've talked extensively on that and other cases in earlier episodes that are landmark presently at the highest levels of the court systems in America. And I mean, this is a picture they have, Apes Together Stronger, which is an absolutely stellar independent film by, as I understand it, just two apes decided to make a movie about how the DTCC has completely screwed over Americans. And they did an exceptional job explaining some of the very nuanced topics behind the failures of our present system in an accessible and understandable way. This is a great independent film. You know, just a couple of guys saw this problem and made a feature-length movie about it that you can go watch on their website. It's like, it's awesome. You know, this is decentralized activism at its core. And the Kennedy campaign at the time kind of did a parody of Apes Together Stronger, where they made a title card where it was RFK with, you know, the ape in the background, the American Eagle on it, you know, alongside releasing this announcement. And it was something that was picked up early on in our community that introduced me to their politics and such. And, you know, that's somebody that's in the cabinet right now. And it might not be in the finance cabinet, but it is someone in a powerful position in the new government come the start of January. It's someone that will be in a powerful position in an era where the president says on record at the largest Bitcoin event closest to the voting date that they will make America the Bitcoin capital of the world, mine minted, all that on American soil. They will fire Chair Gensler on day one and, you know, fix all this so that you know, all the things that they say about you know, because they're obviously just so, I mean, that's a whole other rabbit hole again, but you know, there's some very material contentions in the Web3 industry just because there are, again, a lot of these cryptos that are just raising money from the public and obfuscating American securities laws while they do it to Americans, and it's not legal. There are cases that prove this is not legal. There are some exceptional commission reports like the Dow report or, what was that food? The food one, you know, there's that food company that did it and they published a very extensive report as to why it was a securities violation. These are all, there are a lot of cases where it's pretty clear they're just raising money from the public and they're using blockchain as a system to do it, and they're doing it without any of the investor protections. And there's a whole page on the SEC website that dives into hundreds of these cases. And in a lot of cases, there are fraudsters and there are bad things. You know, this is like the 1920s again. You've got markets evolving and by and large, you know, you've got great companies, great projects, and exceptional developers. They're building really cool things. And they're just using this as a system of raising money to support that because it costs money. You know, you need to organize people in a central manner if you're using the legacy frameworks and paying people to work on your project and such. And there's a lot of organization stuff that goes into that. People need to get paid. That's how the world works. All these things. And that's part of a lot of ongoing work on figuring how to allocate capital to a decentralized system in a way that is accountable and not at the diction of a tyrannical ruler, which, you know, it can work. You can have a tyrant, but it's certainly not sustainable. And I think democracy in itself has proved that, you know, we've seen firsthand that communism is not, you know, totalitarian government, central control. It's just not as effective as the people running the people. And so, you know, this again is someone now in the government. And I think the administration itself has tried to put itself as pro crypto. And they now have, the president has carte blanche on who they assign or recommend to Congress to appoint as the chair of the commission. You know, the commissioners themselves can fire any one of them. And that is accountability into the major regulatory agency that has a very pressing item on their hands when it comes to the Great Taking. UZCA, I do not think will happen fast enough. There's just so much that has to happen on a state level. If we do not preempt this at a federal level, there is a lot at risk that can hurt a lot of people. Federal preemptions of laws exist to fix flaws that exist at state levels that are not consistent. There's a reason so many people want a federal opinion and law on you know, certain extremely contentious topics like, you know, women's rights or abortion. Or I mean, this is what MLK was Jr. was working for decades, to really have a system in place and to test that system when certain states do not follow the federal rules, which, you know, and to get all the states on the same page to amend everyone's UCCs. It's just a mammoth task that could be so much more easily effectuated by a rule at a, you know, there's a reason why blue sky laws on a state level basis are extensively minimal and only used in offerings of securities by and large to investors in a single state, because, you know, historically that's how investing worked. You had to know the person next door if you were going to buy their stock certificate. And indeed, you had to have a company in a town if you were even going to know what they were and invest in them as a, you know, as a wealthy individual. But that was hundreds of years ago. And the financial system, the stock market, these are all global things, and they require at least federal solutions to their, which is exactly what the SEC is. It is a federal solution to an international problem of how do we regulate stock trades. And increasingly lately, that has become a global quandary between every nation. Mm-hmm. And it is a problem not central to any jurisdiction. It is a decentralized challenge that requires a decentralized solution. There is no central board of governors that can control how an individual in Australia transacts with someone in Iceland when it comes to their stock, when it comes to their money. And these are all such crucial aspects of a capitalist system. And at least we could take the first step forward and be the nation that has, you know, we've led securities laws, banking laws, for the entirety of a very large amount of our existence after the creation of the Federal Reserve and, you know, the first 100 years of America. And there's this real pressing, dire question as to whether we will continue to allow, like in the last letter I wrote to the SEC, I talked about a trade I made through a Cayman Islands broker on leveraged Bitcoin futures where I shorted the market and made the money that's paying for the roof over my head. I had I was 80% confident that broker was going to go bankrupt by the time that was like an 8-month trade. I put like $200 into it because I was like, I could put more, but they're probably going to go bankrupt by the time this trade finishes. And that's exactly what we've seen in so many of these institutions register. They claim themselves, they purport themselves as financial institutions, and then they register in some island that no one lives in, and call that a regulated and secure place to transact financial affairs. It's just not. Okay, we've seen so many of those businesses go under. And we need something that's going to work, not just for the next 2 years, but for the next 200, because that is how long financial systems take to come into effect. And that only works on a global scale, only works with blockchain. And of course, you know, I wholeheartedly believe that it only works with investor protections, because I gave that story on the episode about, we were talking about centralized exchanges, we were talking about the Federal Reserve, things like that earlier this year, about, you know, having, you know, the full documentation is at wooten.link/scam. And I just don't think that it is acceptable on a fundamental basis that you can just have these lies and cheats and thefts occur whether it's by a central institution or, again, we talked about laws applying to minors. If you have a financial system where a six-year-old has an account, you can kind of manipulate a six-year-old to do things that might not be in their best interest. And there need to be protections in place. And those protections are so very clearly evident in the Securities Administration and laws present in America that are the total, such a voluminous swath of very strong protections that need to apply to these assets. We've seen over hundreds of years of these protections need to apply to these assets, or else we get the insult again, and everyone loses all their money, the market crashes, and 80% of the population is bankrupt. And I'm not saying that it was only them that caused that, but I am saying that it is a system without any protections that, and with central control and with the fraud and corruption that we see today in the DTCC, that's the kind of system that can really mess up population, mess up society. Why on God's green earth is the chancellor of a foreign nation considering a bailout based on a crisis that occurred on American soil for a financial system that is so fragile that a select few intermediaries cannot cease existence as for-profit institutions and still allow that underlying infrastructure to operate for the people that just want to pay their electric bill?
Right. I mean, I think you've touched on it on a huge swath there, but the undercurrent for me traces back to, first, a recognition that this problem exists and that even though not everyone can put words to it, people are aware that there is an issue here. I think that's something that is born true in the way that people choose to participate in the political process, seeking to find change wherever it might even be just alluded to, promised or not, delivered or not. People want for something to be different. That first, and then second, I hear a lot of optimism, a expectation that there is a chance for things to work out in a positive way. There are individuals that are seeking to change, major hierarchies, in the environmental aspects. I mean, that case against Monsanto is the largest, civil victory, in that entire environmental sector, as far as legal history is concerned, for one example that you brought up, plenty of, similar profiteering exists all over, environmental, in health, in food, and of course in financial engineering. And there are solutions to these problems. It's just that there needs to be a developing understanding from stakeholders and from, people that have voice and power in terms of changing or amending the status quo. And of course, making sure to carry that vision into the future for each one of these different markets. I mean, I think there's a lot of good development to be done, and it's thanks to these modern technologies like blockchain, which can offer accountability and transparency at scale and make things more efficient without needing to consolidate trust into a fewer and fewer handful of, all powerful individuals with their own motivations, and with their own goals at heart, because that was always the trade-off. If you wanted an efficient consolidated system, that meant, consolidating power into single linchpins or, trusting these few individuals, be they elected or otherwise. I know you touched on some other kinds of appointment systems, but, point being, right, we're entering into a new paradigm, and I'm equally excited and optimistic for it. So I think that was maybe a great way to try to wrap things into a big bow as far as what can be done with this technology and what you're specifically trying to do in the context of the financial development in the American market over the last 90 years since the Securities Act and over the last 50 years since the central custodial system was implemented and TAD was shunted to the side, to the annals until you kind of brought it back into this modern framework and are seeking for more traditional support. John, we've certainly been talking for a while, so I'm curious, is there anything else along those veins that you wanted to make sure to touch on, you know, while we were kind of covering the subject in broad at the moment.
Yeah, stellar summary, Ty. I was completely with you, and what a tremendous understanding. You know, we have the key in our hands right now for this lock that Wall Street has erected, this gate that they are using to keep us from true ownership. And it is, of course, the first American decentralized unincorporated nonprofit association, the first American nonprofit DAO. I think that there's just got to be a reason that Wyoming introduced this legislation. It's such a key point in our trajectory as a community who so clearly fits the dire need for some kind of authority delegated to a decentralized community, which is something that is so common in the Web3 industry, yet completely lacking by and large in the incumbent legislations of pretty much most countries. You know, it's a new concept. It's a new thing. And we really are at the forefront of it as the first American DAO. And really, why I really need to get back onto designing the tokenomics, because the influence dynamics here and everything we've been talking about for the last 6 months trying to figure this out right, it is so key, presuming all this scales, because of course we need to provide something. Basically, what you're doing is you're designing court systems on blockchain, and there's quite a bit of tax to do that. The court systems are like relatively well decentralized in America. And so, you know, how do you apply all those principles to a digital court that's all on chain, that operates on pseudonymous identities? It's a Herculean task that is one of the most fun things I can think of to tackle over the next decade. Oh, and we'll need to do it now because we need to get this thing running.
Well, I love that that perspective, because, you know, it needs to be, I think, something where, you know, we can look at this problem and it's easy to say, you know, well, this is just Herculean, as you mentioned, but, you know, reframing it from, you know, it's not some, you know, Sisyphean task to stay on, you know, these Greek names. you know, it's not something like that. This is something that is doable, that is possible to implement and can be a good time. You know, there's, you know, it's a positive feedback loop. I love being able to have these conversations and to try to distill something that is complicated into something a bit more reasonable, and just encourage more and more folks to take the power into their own hands. That is the idea, of course, you know, of a decentralized governance system. You know, I have so much belief in a decentralized governance system because I have so much belief in the intelligence and compassion and forethought of individual participants to choose what is the best future direction for a group. That's something I believe so strongly in. And that's a big part of why, you know, I love also what we're doing and what we've, you know, what we've been able to accomplish, what we will do in the future. There's certainly a lot to touch on in that broad realm, but what's important is that, you know, if you're listening and you want to be involved in that, then your voice is welcome and every bit as important as ours.
Yeah, by all means. I think that's one of the key concepts behind the comment system they have, is that everyone can have a seat at the table. In the past, I know we've had many thousands of members from the community and more contribute to actions to reform the system and to protect us from Wall Street's theft. And so hopefully what we can get across with this comment letter, you know, just short and sweet, the commission, you know, I think one of the best ways to measure your influence on politics is how many footnotes you're in. It's kind of like archaic and weird, but you know, I was at 15 footnotes on the Ed Garnex letter, and obviously the OCC one, they withdrew in defeat, so they didn't publish a final ruling there. And you can kind of see, where you're convincing. You know, it's like throwing your input into a black box, and then you wait 9 months, and if you're lucky, you'll get a response. And, you know, how much you influence that response is really our primitive objective. You know, how much you influence the system, that is governance at its core. I mean, that is whether everybody gets one vote or whether a tyrant dictates everything. So core governance, so core to this idea that people are smart, you know, and that the change should come from the users of the system, not the owners of it, so to speak, in the centralized framework. Completely with you there, Chives, since it just loved sentiments. And what I found is that they really take, reading hundreds of rules and thousands of comments and all these things, they really take consolidated comment letters very seriously, in the sense that they will quite ardently cite consolidated comment letters in the final rules and in my opinion, their interpretation and judgment of how they make the rule. Part of it is, I think, you know, it's just hard to keep in track in your head, you know, 1,000 people's different perspective, or even just 1,000 different PDFs. I mean, that's quite a bit of work, and you have to like formally cite out each and every comment letter if you're going to reference it at all. And indeed, if you're going to build a policy around it, it's kind of like, you've got 1,000 ants, right? And each ant might have a really good idea, but if you have to kind of individually nick down and get your tweezers out and grab the ant and then try to put it into a big frame, you know, that's where people's voices get lost in democracies, and it's how centralized power accrues into a select few that maybe aren't the will, so to speak, of what all the ants would want if all their voices were adequately heard. I mean, you know, as any governance system works, and that certainly ties into some of the innovations that we're exploring on the voting side, which is a whole other topic. But, if you can consolidate all of those perspectives into something that's a little bit more cohesive, not super, like, I'm not talking censorship here. I'm just trying to put everything in one place. So instead of 1,000 ants, we have a document that you can reference, and you can say, this is the perspective of Main Street. And these are the thoughts that everyone has. You quote everybody so that it's all, you know, super transparent, and you're just giving them, it's like, you know, we've got all the raw ingredients here. We've got the flour, the sugar, the eggs. And what we can do now is combine all those, right? So, you know, we could give the commission all these individual items and say, you know, here's all the answers, kind of, sort of, you know, nobody has all the answers, but, you know, here are all the ingredients. That's a better word for it. Here are all the ingredients. Go make the cake yourself. And I think that's what TAD, the original release, was. To a point, it was these actors all independently finding all the ingredients of what is the most efficient stock market. And then they all collaborated and wrote up this 60-page document and submitted it to the commission and to Congress and all these other people. And they said, here is the cake that we're making from all of our ingredients that we have found on it. You know, one person goes and makes the flour. One person goes and harvests the eggs. All the things that you'd expect in an efficient market with specialization. And you kind of combine all that together. So it's just a little bit less work for the policymakers. Because I've seen firsthand, you can spend thousands of hours sifting through different viewpoints, and I always read every single comment letter on any rule that I even considered touching. It's hard, because, you know, in the legacy context where central intermediaries are the only ones commenting and Wall Street is really the only one participating in the legislative process, it's easy to understand the perspective that you're viewing. It's easy to say, okay, this comment letter is from DTCC. We can understand the interests that they're probably going to represent without even looking at it. Or you can say that, you know, this comment letter is from Citadel, and you can understand you sort of get the perspective and the background that they're coming from. But there's really nothing like that for Main Street. And all we've had up to this point is just these mass comment letters, or submitting in mass templates together, where one person who might or might not have certain vested interests goes and says, this is what the new policy should be. And if you agree with me, submit the same PDF. And indeed, that's what we've done with the NFCC position petition. By and large, is it's just, you know, people submitting all the same viewpoints and number go up, you know, as to the size of it. And then, you know, what I found is that even when you get really large numbers of supporters behind a comment letter template, it is quite common if that is a very contentious item for that template to not really have the effect that you would think it should have on the rulemaking process. Because quite often, you know, these regulators, they are dealing with rules that are hundreds of pages to change. And if it takes hundreds of pages to make four changes in a rule, then you can imagine just how much there is here in the existing regulations today. And so I kind of think that there's this deference that, you know, a thousand or 10,000 or a million, you know, everyone submitting one viewpoint, it's not going to take into account the complexity and tact that exists in the present regulatory system. And indeed, it's sort of like, you know, if we all were in the very early days of computers and we decided to build a clock application for the desk, and we all, you know, one person built a clock application as an example, and then everybody says you need to use this clock application, this is the best clock application in the world, everybody use this clock application, but it's really only the development efforts of one person or one group of people if it's a proprietary closed source solution, it's just not going to be the best system. Because now you've got this other company that's competing with you to build a clock application, and they put 5,000 employees behind it where you only have 50 employees. And so now theirs is the best. But then this other third company comes in and they put 10,000 employees behind it, on and on. Everyone's competing to build the best clock application. But you know, you only really need one best system here. You only really need the best clock application. Let's just all be real here. You don't need 50 competing clock applications to tell you what the time is. It's just not necessary. And I've looked very extensively into the design of typography, so like different fonts, and how competition between firms, and specifically like one of the most popular fonts on the planet is Helvetica, and it is the rights for it are sort of controlled by this private German company that by all means very innovative, and it's used, they get some nice royalty payments from Apple, but Microsoft, on the other hand, intentionally designed a copycat font through extensive work to basically avoid paying licensing fees to use Helvetica. And there's an entire documentary on the design and typeface of Helvetica that is accompanied by a 600-page book of interviews for the people that built Helvetica, and kind of a big focus on it is how this particular centralized institution basically said that they're not going to, you know, we don't want to pay $1 million a year to use Helvetica, so we're going to spend $50 million designing. I don't know how much they spent designing an alternative. It's a central institution, and that kind of nuance doesn't make its way into SEC reports. But, you know, it's just trying to copy the open standard. It's such a common thing that happens in some of the innovations of open source. I mean, we're talking about here about proprietary blockchains that are just stealing from the Web3 industry every ounce of inspiration that comes exclusively from these open source developers that build just the best systems that they can think of for their specific applications. And to see that now we have this threat of a monopoly that is decades old, taking that technology, gatekeeping it, centralizing it, and perpetuating their extensive flaws, you know, trying to make their own clock application from the work of tens, if not hundreds, if not millions of open source developers over the years and researchers that have been building these frameworks out for decades, if not centuries. On the regulation side, regulation is like an example of open source. Everybody can take, you can look at every single word in a regulation, just like you can work at every single line of code in Bitcoin. You can look at every single process that goes into changing Bitcoin's code, just like you can look at every single process that goes into drafting a bill and then changing laws. they're surprisingly quite similar, at least with FOIA. And oh my god, okay, whole rabbit hole there. I'm gonna work that into this comment later. But
the big takeaway, right, is that these tools are there, and it's, you know, it's a big undertaking to, you know, do something as diligent as you described. You know, not only, you know, first hurdle, knowing that you can publicly participate in the regulatory development, right? Second hurdle, actually taking the time to research what proposals or what adjustments are up for public comment in that moment. You know, third, then you have to read the rule. Fourth, then you suggested reading all the other comments to get a more nuanced understanding of the perception of other players in the space. Because, of course, as you mentioned, legacy participation has been, essentially majority utilized by these market incumbents, these giant industry players. And, you know, if you're a regular retail investor that doesn't have millions of dollars, that doesn't have, you know, direct access to a dark pool or a high frequency trading firm that's in your corner, right? You're just going through a broker like any of your neighbors. Probably you're not aligned very closely with the desires of, your BlackRocks or your Citadels or your Virtues, right? It's a completely different type of market participation that these guys are after. And so I'm right there with you. You can develop a much more nuanced understanding of the implications that are expected for a given policy proposal by looking to see what these other guys are asking for. And it's been so encouraging to see over the last couple of years, the amount of individuals that are participating in this process keeps on going up. And that is, you know, I think in large part thanks to a variety of different, online investor communities that are really encouraging individuals to grasp on to this power that they have. And it's a wonderful thing to see. And that's something definitely that, that we want to encourage at YDRS, regardless of what you as an individual may think the ideal market looks like. If you're someone who does participate in the American markets, then you have the ability to comment on their function and should use that ability. You know, it is your right, and you should know how to exercise it. And it's wonderful to see, not only that ethos exists from a regulatory perspective, but it being, reimagined through the open source lens, for something that we're doing as well for any of the ongoing, developments, with these projects. So I'm glad that you had brought that up and gave us a chance to countersink how important it is for folks to, engage in the process. Or, you know, I suppose if you're, a lot of folks are busy, that means, finding a trustworthy, open community that you can be a part of and that things can be, disseminated outwards. Things like the NSCC closeout petition from about 2 months ago is one example where folks recognize that the settlement practices, not to go into much detail there, but folks agreed with the overview of the problem, and so we had hundreds help to submit that petition through the community, which was really excellent to see. Now, who knows how many of them read into detail, but they certainly had enough of an affiliation with it that they felt comfortable to sign on board. So excellent stuff there as well. And let's see, I think my voice, I think I may need to call it soon, John. I don't know how you're feeling. I don't know how your water's doing.
Oh my god, I ran out quite some time ago. I'm down to tap water. It's not until we can get rid of the so many political things about tap water, of all things, are now coming to light because of RFK. It's interesting. It's like, yeah, I'm with you there, Ty. I think you did a tremendous job, and just a lot of work to come on the GitHub, which I've tried to kind of start framing in the discussion, but obviously it's been brewing for quite some time.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, right? Seeds on seeds, and things will grow from here. And so thank you, as always, John, for coming on and digging into more detail about the history and context that kind of led you to this point, led your work to this point, and you know, that what we've linked, you know, we'll have some other stuff in the description notes, but certainly, you know, those initial discussions are well worth checking out, both on the that comments repo, but also, you know, on your own page, because I know you have a lot of other source links, other ideas that people can check out and become engaged with if they so choose. But either way, we'll continue to try to bring things to the forefront in an effective way. Something else that we can always be trying to improve at to further disseminate and decentralize the impact of the information. So in any case, wonderful stuff, John. Thank you. Any closing thoughts or anything like that?
Well, you know, Abe Lincoln was as I understand, it's the only president that had a patent. And this is way back when it was quite the process to do so. And, you know, his career, he was a lawyer. His son actually went on to become the general counsel for kind of the railroad monopolies, the biggest railroads as they emerged as systemic infrastructure across America, and indeed expanded from just the East Coast to spanning the whole continent. And, you know, one thing I was really inspired by reading his a biography of him was that Lincoln, you know, he became a lawyer not by going to law school. He quite famously grew up in the middle of nowhere, as most people were at the time. It was very decentralized community. It was a decentralized nation. I mean, to get places, there was no car. You know, you were walking or on horse or these sorts of things. And so when speed is slow, centralization is quite necessary for any reasonable amount of efficiency. And, you know, he grew up on a farm and just started reading law textbooks one day, started reading journals, started reading the court documents, and, you know, lo and behold, early in his career, starts practicing law. Decades later, very well-respected attorney. You know, I think what we can do when we enable people to really take their career into their own hands, it has just profound implications on social mobility and capitalistic efficiency that I really think would be well applied to the American securities trading and settlement regimes.
There we go. That's right. You know, we get the information in front of the people. People are going to be curious, and things will get better. I think there's only upward mobility that comes from, you know, disseminating a better understanding amongst the population. That's the beauty of education, the beauty of open access, and something that is so well and duly provided by these technological advancements of internet, blockchain, social media. Terrific. And, you know, I would even go further to say that the profit motive, if we could remove that from these informational highways and really make it about learning and education, then that would be even better. But yeah, here we are on a for-profit platform at the moment. So one thing at a time.
Yeah, I mean, it's what exists today, and it doesn't need to be that way as a starting point for the trade, for the stock market.
All right. Well, with that, I think a terrific episode here. Definitely a long one and an in-depth one. So I'm looking forward to the ensuing commentary. Folks, make sure to check out John's work. And John, thank you so much as always for hopping on and explaining a bit about this. And I'm looking forward to seeing any comments on the comment ahead of time as we move into this new administration and look forward to finding out who the new SEC chairman is going to be and what kind of perspective they might have on not only in the implementation of crypto, but of course on a reimagining of the TAD idea from decades prior. So on the edge of my seat, thanks so much, John, again, and be well, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.